This 50th Statehouse blend was recorded in front of a live audience at Westport Flea Market on January 28th.
Introduce yourselves, please.
I'm John Rubin. I'm a state representative in Kansas from the 18th District, which is essentially the eastern half of the city of Shawnee. This is my third term, and I'm privileged to chair the House Corrections and Juvenile Justice Committee.
And I'm John Wilson, state representative from the 10th House District in Kansas, which is southeastern Lawrence and rural Douglas County in Baldwin City.
And we have a room full of people here, and I'm not really sure why, but I'm going to check on that while we listen to the open.
This is Statehouse Blend. I'm Sam Zeff.
And I'm Brian Ellison. We're using coffee
and donuts
to better understand the legislatures on both sides of the state line,
the issues and the people in Topeka
and Jeff City. Here we go.
All right, and here we go with the 50th episode of Statehouse Blend. And to celebrate, we've invited not just one citizen guest, but a whole room full of guests here at the Westport Flea Market. Going to help us get to know John Rubin and John Wilson a little bit better. Also joining us, my KCUR colleague Steve Kraske, host of Up to Date. Great to have you here with
us, Sam.
Tonight. We're going to get to some preliminary questions for our guests, but while I'm doing that, I want you guys to think about questions that you want to ask both Representative Rubin or Representative Wilson, and you'll go to this microphone over there. But as we always do on State House Blend, we start with my two favorite questions. And John Wilson, we're looking for an update on your kids and your pets.
Great. So my son Parker is fabulous, really into jigsaw puzzles now, so loving that. And our dog Sadie, 17 years old and still kicking, and just the dog and the kid don't necessarily get along all the time, though.
I was hoping that Sadie was still with us from the last time. Last time you were with us, it was day 107, I believe, of the Kansas legislature, and you were stuck in your basement office at the State House. Are you still in the basement?
Still in the basement, or some might call the garden level.
John Rubin, an update on your family.
Well, our oldest daughter, Shayna, son-in-law, Stephen, and our three grandchildren live in Denver. Somehow, and I think I've said this before, you examine your life and try to figure out where you failed as parents because she's a rabid Broncos fan. Our youngest grandchild, our granddaughter, Genevieve, who we call Vivi, just turned two last week. Our youngest daughter, our other child, our youngest daughter, is single, lives in Atlanta. And our pets are all the Cardinals, Blue Jays, Robins, and turtle doves that feed at our bird feeders out back.
Yeah, I like that. I want to get straight to questions here pretty soon. But first, I want to start with something that happened yesterday. The two of you joined forces on a transparency campaign. First two representatives to sign a transparency pledge. And so as I was reading the story, the first thing I thought was, well, so where did transparency go, John Rubin? Where did it go in Kansas?
It's a lot less prevalent now than it was several years ago. And there are a number of things that John and I or others are working together to try to counteract. As I said yesterday during the signing ceremony, our state and our nation are founded on the basis of governments of, by, and for the people. And for the life of me, I cannot understand how you can be a government of, by, and for the people if you hide things from the people. And it seems to me that anybody that occupies a taxpayer-funded office or position in the state of Kansas, be they elected, appointed, or an employee of the state at all levels and whatever their work is, owes it to the people of Kansas to be as transparent as possible in what they do, how they arrive at decisions, what those decisions are, and making all of that as widely available to the public, to their constituents in the case of elected officials, and the public at large in Kansas.
John Wilson, I'm wondering if, absolutely.
Thank you.
First Amendment fans here tonight, you can't beat that. But my question is, were we more transparent, and if we were in the past, and I make part of my living on the Kansas Open Records Act and Kansas Open Meetings Act. So if some of that transparency has gone away, where did it go and what happened?
So I think it's helpful to understand the places where we can be more transparent. So certainly within the House and Senate, there's the rules that we follow that can make it hard to follow where bills are going, how many bills are being packaged together in a conference committee report. So that's one place we need to find more transparency. The other is the cost of open records requests and the timeliness that people are acting upon those. So we have organizations out there looking for really important data on where the state is spending its money or not spending its money that we can't get that information. So that's another place we need transparency. Another one is in the access the press has for various meetings that happen in the State House and with the government. And I think finally, a place where there's a lack of transparency is, unfortunately, we have a lot of lawmakers who choose to go back to their districts and tell people what they want to hear and talk to the people that will most likely support them rather than talking to all people who might have different ideas than they do.
And I want to move on to questions from the audience. So, but first, Steve Kraske, I want you to get in on this.
Yeah.
Reporter, journalism professor, what do you think happened to transparency in Kansas?
Well, I wonder because, you know, certainly the history of Kansas going back any number of decades, Sam, is that the state sort of had this patina, I guess, of good government and government being run the right way. And I'm not so sure transparency was as big an issue back in the 80s when I was covering the State House on a daily basis into the early 90s. But you do get a sense now that something has changed and something has been lost. And I'm not sure why that is.
Why is that? Either John.
I, at the risk of alienating some people, I think if you're not proud of the work that you're doing, then you don't want people to hear about it.
John Rubin, wait a minute. That's an interesting charge. React to that for me.
Well, that's certainly one thing. As I said at the outset, some people perhaps want to hide some of their votes from their constituents, the public at large. Another is really expediency. That's the problem with bundling of bills. Bundling of bills, without getting too far into the weeds, is a practice that is getting worse, has been getting worse in the state of Kansas until a rule change that I carried to amend the rules made it a little better last year, but we haven't gone far enough yet. It allows, at the end of session, a large number of bills to be packaged together in one document called a conference committee report. So before the rules changed last year, 6, 8, 10, 12 bills that had passed either the House or Senate could be packaged together in a conference committee report. It would come out to the floor in the House and the Senate. Oftentimes, legislators didn't even know everything that was in the package and had one vote up or down on it. We've limited that now to 5. That needs to get down to at least 2, 1 or 2 in a conference committee report. And that's a way to ensure that you're going to be less informed on what you're voting on for the people and to have things you're going to be voting against, for or against as part of one package. It's not the way to make public policy.
Before we move on, I just want to touch one more issue on this, and that is the issue of committee-sponsored bills. Used to be that you could look at a piece of legislation and you would know who wrote that legislation, who were the sponsors. Now most of the legislation, I think, in Kansas comes out of committee. Is this a transparency issue for you too?
John, go ahead.
You know, that's a good question. You know, when I first came into the legislature in 2013, I was kind of implied that committee bills are probably going to go further than bills sponsored by an individual, just because perhaps your name has some baggage or your political affiliation has some baggage with it. The other challenge, though, with putting your name on a bill because of legislative rules and processes is you could put your name on a bill, House Bill 2020, and they could gut that bill and make it a completely different thing, and your name is still going to be attached to it. So maybe I have a gun violence prevention bill that all of a sudden becomes a concealed carry bill, and then my name is still on it. And so that puts people on the hook for that.
Yeah, we're going to talk. Oh, go ahead, John.
Just real quickly. So there are good, legitimate reasons to have committee-sponsored bills instead of individual bills. I will say in my committee, the committee I chair, Corrections and Juvenile Justice, you can find out who introduced committee bills in my committee. They still have to be introduced by somebody before the chairman and the committee, and then the committee adopts it as a committee bill. And our minutes, I'm not sure this is true in every committee, but our minutes reflect in every case who introduced that bill as a committee bill in my committee. It requires a little digging. You have to look at the minutes, but you can find it.
Steve Kraske, where do we go next?
Well, I just want to bring up the elephant in the room here, if I can. You know, when I talk to some of my neighbors, not all of them, but certainly some of them, you get a sense that a lot of people in Kansas feel like the state is careening. careening a little bit out of control here. Can't hire enough investigators to investigate felony crimes. Can't hire enough mental health workers to properly staff Osawatomie State Hospital. Teachers fleeing the state. These kinds of basic building block employees who sort of form the foundation of the state of Kansas. Record deficits, record tax increases, and people are sitting back wondering, what in the world is going on over there? And that's what I'd like to begin the conversation with here a little bit. What's going on in Topeka?
I'm going to suggest not disappointing this crowd, so what's going on?
Right. Well, John, would you like to take a stab at it first?
Okay. Steve looked at me when he said the elephant in the room. I am a Republican.
That was intentional.
Problem number one is the large income tax cuts that were enacted in 2012 that you all have heard so much about were not accompanied by calculated, reasoned spending cuts in areas where spending could be cut. There are areas where spending actually can be cut in Kansas. I never have and never will support across-the-board cuts because those are mindless and cut in agencies that cannot afford any cuts. They say where you sit is where you stand. I'm chair of corrections, and I can tell you public safety in Kansas cannot afford any cuts. We're understaffed at the KBI. We're understaffed at the Highway Patrol. I can guarantee you we are severely understaffed at the Department of Corrections, and we have high turnover rates. And there are a number of other problems, too. Public safety cannot afford any cuts. There are other areas that can. We commissioned a study, paid $2 or $3 million of taxpayers' money for the study. It's called the Alvarez and Marcel study that identified, they just reported, identified over $2 billion, not, can't all be recognized immediately, but $2 billion in efficiencies by eliminating, in a lot of cases, just a lot of duplication, IT, for example, a lot of things that can be saved in the budget. So there is room for savings in the budget most departments, and that can be done. So that should be done. But the other thing that needs to be done is we need to eliminate government favoritism. We have far too many tax exemptions and credits that are only there because privileged individuals or more often businesses that can afford lawyers and lobbyists get that special tax treatment, whether we're talking about sales tax or income tax exemptions. Those need to be eliminated as well. We can have the funding we need for vitally important state programs, all of them, education, roads, public safety, and all of them, if we look at the savings in recommended by the efficiency study, and we look to eliminate a lot of these unnecessary exemptions.
You know, let me just challenge that for a moment. I mean, exemptions, John Rubin, will help, but when we're talking about borrowing hundreds of millions of dollars from the highway fund, when we're talking about not having enough investigators to go out and investigate felonies around the state of Kansas, when we're talking about teachers fleeing the state because of uncertain economic futures and low pay, what are we left with here? I mean, it seems to me it goes, there's something more fundamental here going on than tinkering with the tax code. There's a cratering going on here that I'm not sure I'm seeing recognized in the rhetoric coming out of the State House day after day. John, let me take this, John, here.
Sure. All right. So I think that's a great question. I first want to say the approach that I take in governing is always trying to find common ground, and I'm confident that John and I will find common ground on some of the recommendations from the A&M efficiency report, particularly on things like IT consolidation. I do think, though, that had we not enacted the 2012 tax plan that did essentially two things, collapsed our income tax brackets from 3 to 2, and then exempted what's now about 330,000 businesses from paying income taxes. Those two changes, had those not happened, we'd have roughly $1 billion surplus right now. And with that surplus, you could do the things that you mentioned, Steve. And so, but I think here's what I think you were getting at. From my vantage point, we're letting an ideology dictate policy as opposed to just some reason and some facts and some clear metrics. We're not seeing the jobs come into Kansas that we were told would happen because of the tax cuts. Additionally, I think the thing that's happening in the State House is there's kind of a choir of organizations that seem to have a grip on the power in the State House. That's, you know, the Kansas Chamber of Commerce is one. The Americans for Prosperity is another one. You have a group called CLEAR, which scores policies based on their whether they're free market and limited governance and other things. And so if those don't have a good score, then people who are members of CLEAR are going to have challenges with those bills. And then you have, so those are kind of fiscal groups. And then you have a group like the Kansas Policy Institute, which creates white papers that support, that can be used as support for some of these ideologically driven policy changes. That's all on the fiscal side of thing. And then there are social issues that, there are groups that drive social issues. So when combined, they have the ability to kind of control the conversation in the Capitol. And for those in the audience who haven't been to the Capitol, it all really starts with the Speaker of the House in terms of the House, who gets to appoint committee chairs, who then get to determine the bills that are heard. And correct me if I'm wrong, John, but if you get too far out of line or if you do something that the leadership doesn't like, there's a good chance you won't be chair anymore, even though we try to have a little bit of independence. So it is a structure that by design keeps power to a certain group of people. So fundamentally, it's about, I think, an ideology driving policy rather than really stepping back and realizing what are the facts.
I want to just follow up on that because you brought up an interesting point, and that is, and apparently, and I think John Wilson is right, if you get too far out of line, there's been a number of moderates who've been kicked off the health committee, there's been moderates who have, Republicans who have been kicked off the education committee. So how much pressure are you feeling from leadership, John Rubin?
Well, I personally don't feel any pressure. Because I'm going to do what my conscience and the principles that caused me to run for office in the first place tell me to do and let the chips fall where they may. It's the same thing I say actually to the leadership, the same thing I say to constituents in my district. Here's where I stand on the issues. Here's what I promise you. I will always be as well informed as I possibly can be about the issues. I will cast an informed vote and I will tell you how I voted and why. Now, any politician that tells you that they're going to, you know, vote the way you want them to vote, that's obviously ridiculous. We got 22,000 constituents. We can't possibly do that. So that's a false promise. But what I do promise is what I said. And if the constituent at whose door I'm speaking, where I'm talking to them, say, well, I don't agree with that, and I'll say, well, that's fine. That's fair enough. By all means, vote for another candidate. Here's where I stand on this issue. If it's an issue that I'm not well informed on, I'll say, well, I'll get information before I make a decision on that one. But if it's something that I have as a firm principle, a reason why I ran for office in the first place, I'll say, if you agree with that, by all means vote for me. If not, that's where I stand. I'm not going to change. By all means vote for someone else. And I actually say the same thing to leadership. Here's where I stand. I confronted leadership quite directly on the rules changes I talked about, the one about bundling, and another one you might be surprised to know, back on transparency for a minute. And I would like to 1 second to respond to Steve as well. But on the issue of transparency, another rules change that I sponsored that we didn't get passed yet is that not all votes in the Kansas House are recorded. Votes on what we call general orders, which is the first vote on a bill or resolution, is more often than not recorded. Again, I think that hides from our constituents how we are really voting on something. So I fought on both of those. Leadership did not like that at all. I can guarantee you they did not like it. But I told them I'm not going to change, Mr. Speaker. If you want to remove me as chair of corrections, by all means, that's your prerogative. But I'm not going to change my views on this. I'm still chair of corrections.
All right. Seeing no questions from the audience, this is what we're going to do.
There's one there.
They're coming. Here they come. It's like the cavalry.
All right. All they needed was a little prodding. Right. Say your name and where you're from.
My name is John Martellaro. I'm from Lenexa, and I'm a board member of Kansas Families for Education.
And your question?
I'm an older person, and when I was in school, all you really needed to run a school was a blackboard, a couple pieces of chalk, a felt eraser, some pencils, and some textbooks. That's not how it works anymore, but we're cutting education. And I look at who the big, important, growing private sector employers are. I see Garmin, I see Black & Veatch, I see Cerner. You can't walk into one of those places without being well-versed in high-tech skills. And as we're cutting our education budget, and we are spending now less per student than we were 3 or 4 years ago, how are we proving to these private sector businesses that we're supposed to be, at least according to the majority, supporting, how are we preparing a workforce that they can depend on in the state of Kansas? And as we cut education, aren't we practically begging them to move to someplace like Minnesota where they invest in their schools?
Education is a perpetual topic here on State House Blend. John, I'm going to start with Representative Rubin. We've talked on a number of stories, and I've heard you say that you think that that there may be we may be able to cut even further from education. How do you respond to John?
I'm glad to have this opportunity to respond. Actually, I didn't quite say that. I said that we have not yet cut in spending. Every year since I've been there, spending on education has gone up over the year before. The only time, I know I'm going to say some things that are unpopular with some of you here, but I don't have the numbers in front of me tonight. I didn't bring them, but I can certainly provide them to anybody that would like them. Our per pupil spending, let me just say a couple of things. And it's, as I say, I know it's going to be unpopular with many of you, but it's not only the way I feel, but I have the evidence to back it up. Our spending on education per pupil is over $14,000 something a year, which is an all-time high in the state of Kansas. That's number one. Now, many of you will say, well, yeah, but that includes spending on CAPERS. And my response is, you show me one other profession or private industry of any kind that doesn't count retirement and other fringe benefits as part of the cost of doing business. Beyond that, there's no question that spending on education is the third rail of Kansas politics. Just like spending on entitlements at the federal level, Social Security, Medicare, is the third rail of federal politics. But facts are facts. We are the fourth highest state in the country in the percent of our budget that of our state general fund budget, which is the one that we control in the legislature, that we spend on K through 12 education in Kansas. That consumes about 52% of our budget. The national average is about 37%. Two other factors, and I'll try to say this as quickly as possible. There's two other areas where I think we can see some substantial savings and actually enhance education and get more money into the classroom. There are many of us conservative legislators in Kansas that have said for years, we're not spending enough in the classroom and we're spending way too much overhead. The average right now that we're spending in the classroom is about 55%. Many of us, myself included, would like to see that number increase to 65%. But why is it not more? It's because we have so much overhead. The percent of K through 12 spending in Kansas that has by far gone up the most, the percent of the budget, is overhead and administrative costs. That's not getting into the classroom. It's not educating your kids and the kids of the people of Kansas. We could go a long way to reducing those overhead costs by consolidating school districts. I didn't say schools. I'm not talking about closing one schoolhouse door. I'm not talking about busing one student. But there is a bill now pending in the legislature that I support that will reduce the number of school districts from 286 to 132. So we'll have 132, most of those superintendents make six-figure salaries. So we would greatly consolidate the number of school superintendents, assistant superintendents, their plant, their building, their IT, and all the costs of running those district offices so we can get more money into the classroom. One other point I'd like to make. We have already appropriated money that many school districts are refusing to spend. And I don't sit on the Education Committee or on any budget committee, but the latest figure I believe I heard is that there's now over $1.5 billion in what we call unencumbered funds that school districts are holding. These are funds that are not committed to everyday operational expenses, and they are not committed to building. And while some of that needs to be kept for rainy day fund purposes, certainly nowhere near that amount. And I'd like to require school districts to start using some of that money that we have already appropriated that they have not so far spent and they've refused to spend.
John Wilson, give me the other side of that, because there's a lot to say to what Representative Rubin just said.
Right. So I think... rather than focus on the numbers and the figures, I think what we're seeing happen in the Capitol is maybe a fundamental difference of opinion about the role that education plays in our state economy and the role that education plays in making sure that young people grow up to be thriving and successful adults regardless of what they choose to do. And so Representative Rubin is right. If you take a dollar bill, if a dollar bill represents our state budget, if you fold that in half, that much is how much we spend on K-12 education. Fold it a little bit more, that's 60% represents higher education and K-12 together. There are plenty of people in the Capitol that believe we're spending too much on education and would agree with John's sentiments about overhead. Where I'm coming from is that we have fewer and fewer students who are actually showing up in the classroom who are ready to learn because of so many factors happening outside of the schoolhouse. And so when we have a growing rate of childhood poverty, we have more people who don't have jobs, we have families that are struggling to make ends meet, we put more pressure on teachers to make sure that there are good academic outcomes when the reality is we need more supports for kids before they even get to school, and because of the budget crisis we find ourselves in, we have fewer ways to help those kids so that they are ready to learn in the classroom. So I think it's a lot of things. There's the question of money going to the classroom, but we have to make sure that there are all kinds of supports in the school in the first place, and some of that might not be a teacher, but it's counselors, it's social workers, it's nurses, it's other things. And so it's modern education has increased costs, but it's the best thing we have for the state economy, I think.
I want to bring Stephen on this in just a second, but just one quick follow-up with you, John Wilson. So you talked about nurses, you talked about counselors. You think that the cost of those people should be included in what is referred to as in-classroom educational costs?
Well, because we have to, I do. I also think about what's happening, you know, librarians and the reading specialists and all these things that are just necessary for modern education now. So those are all part of the cost of doing business in a school.
Yeah. Steve, you cover education a lot on UpToDate. We've talked a number of times about stories. What's your question here about education in Kansas going forward?
Again, I sort of want to go back to the broader issue here. And I'm just wondering, because I look at the world through the prism of politics, much to my detriment. What I'm wondering is, at this point, you know, more than 3 years after the big tax cuts were enacted, I'm wondering if... I've talked to some lawmakers privately, Republicans, who say, yeah, you know, we overstepped, we went too far, we've got to readjust. And I'm wondering at this point, is this legislature capable of sitting back and saying, okay, we went too far, we've got to regroup? Or are the politics here so intractable that it'll never happen? And what I mean by that is for Republicans, the governor, to sit back and say, okay, we overstep, we have to retrench, regroup, modify those tax cuts, would be seen as so politically damaging that there's no way that lawmakers would ever go there. So what I'm wondering, bottom line, is do politics hold you all back from adjusting those tax cuts?
So I'll start. It's a good question.
Yeah.
Let me just say that I have a really rich and meaningful life outside of the State House, and so I go into that building every day knowing that if I lose this gig, I still have got a great life to go back to. The one thing I lose is the ability to be in a position to push a button and vote for policies that have the ability to improve people's lives into the future. So that's what I would lose. So I know I'm ready to make some tough choices. But I would say even if the House and Senate are on board to make changes to the tax policy, we have a governor that it probably won't back down on his signature tax policy. So that's problematic. But I do think there's increasing frustration about the tax policy. But again, there are a few people in the building that call the shots and can decide even whether a bill ever comes up to have a discussion. And so we have fewer and fewer places to have meaningful and thoughtful discussion about it. And honestly, for the past couple of years, there's been amendments brought up on the House floor to completely go back to pre-2012 tax plans. But I also don't think that's the way to make sound tax policy, is just a gotcha amendment on the House floor without having the full picture of it all. Nobody makes good decisions when you're backed into a corner, so that's why we just need to have a thoughtful, really candid conversation. I'll be honest, you know, I'm proud to be a Democrat, but that is way down on the list of things that are important to me when I'm in that building. But as a Democrat, I would have had so much more respect for Sam Brownback had he started his State of the Union this year saying, everybody, in 2012, I set out for one of the most ambitious tax changes in the country, and we had a goal in mind to do this, and I'm sorry to tell you, it hasn't worked, and it is, you know what, I know a lot of people's lives have been hurt by this, and I'm going to do what I can to fix it. I think all of us would have been supportive of something like that, but it hasn't happened. He's just mismanaging things at this point, unfortunately for ideological reasons.
John Rubin, very quickly, it's always been my impression that you were neither a great supporter of Sam Brownback nor a great somebody who is a big detractor. So where are you on this? Do you? I think I've heard you say before that we need to correct what happened in 2012.
It's certainly fair to say I agree with the governor on some things. I disagree on others. In answer to Steve's question, I can't speak for others of my colleagues on the Republican side of the aisle. But for me, it is not politics that constrain what I do in the legislature. I already told you all. I tell my constituents freely. I'm right there with John. I'm a retired federal judge. I'm doing this because of the principles I believe in, not because I need to do it. And if I'm not reelected next year, if the people choose someone else, that's fine. It's democracy in action. But it's not going to change the principles that I ran on and that I follow in the legislature. And one of those principles is the economic engine of growth in Kansas is small business. And that is why I voted for those tax cuts when they occurred and would again, including the elimination of most, not all, income taxes on pass-through businesses. But the problem, and where I criticize the governor, and I have done so openly, and so we've had some pointed discussions on this point, is that the one reason that I would put the word irresponsible on those tax cuts is they were not accompanied by corresponding spending cuts. Tax cuts almost, or in some cases larger than what we enacted in Kansas, have been enacted in other states like Wisconsin, even in New Jersey and Indiana, but they are accompanied by corresponding cuts and unnecessary spending. That's what Governor Brownback didn't do. Every budget he's presented to the legislature since I've been there has increased spending, which is why I've voted against every budget except one.
All right, back to the audience. Name and where you're from.
Is this on? I'm sorry. Scott Gregory. I'm a CPA from Roland Park. Everybody knows that the revenue situation in Kansas is a disaster. There is absolutely no rationale for not taxing a type of business, and you mentioned pass-through entities, including sole proprietorships. I've got a young lawyer making about $150,000, not paying any Kansas income tax. He's driving on the streets. His kids are going to Kansas schools. That's not right. At the same time, I got three old folks in nursing homes whose medical deduction has been cut by Mr. Brownback's law, and they're paying more in medical expense than their adjusted gross income, and they're still paying Kansas income tax. That's not right either. But it's a typical Republican ploy to try to blame it on spending. You've got this unconstitutional block grant sham going on with the schools right now. It's not going to stand. I question your statistics on increased spending per pupil. The per pupil spending does not meet the constitutionally mandated minimum and hasn't for years. And much of what is being counted as per pupil spending is capital expenditures or one-time contributions to CAPERS.
Right, let's get to a question here. We need a question.
A question?
Yeah.
What are you going to do to fix it? Are you going to vote to undo those unconscionable income tax rules?
We've talked budget, so are you going to get a chance to, do you think there's going to be a bill that's going to come out that that there'll be a chance to vote on that? Either of you.
John, you want to go first, and then I'll...
My sense is there's already a bill out there that might actually be tied to reducing the food sales tax, because, fun fact, we have some of the highest sales tax on food in the country.
And I would support that bill.
As a part of last year's the largest tax increase in Kansas history, the discussion said we definitely need to address the sales tax on food. So there was a commitment made last year, and I think there's a bill that does that and pays for it. I think Mark Hutton's bill by changes to the pass through income part of the tax changes. I'll tell you, because I oppose the 2012 tax plan doesn't mean I think we need to just go all the way back. We need to have a thoughtful, candid conversation about the types of tax incentives we have for businesses and appropriate rates for that. So I am pushing for us to have a debate on that issue.
John Rubin, yes or no? Are you behind lowering the sales tax on food?
I am in favor of lowering the sales tax on food. I would like to see it eliminated. It's not. I know, in interest of time, I'm not going to respond to the previous. Have time to respond to everything the previous questioner said, except to say that I fundamentally disagree with him. I can tell you one thing. When I cite numbers, they are facts. I don't misrepresent numbers. So if we disagree on principle, as I've said, that's fine. We disagree. But I do think that if we had... The problem was, in addition to reducing spending, as I mentioned, the other problem was... The governor took half measures with regard to the income tax. If he was convinced that the way to stimulate the Kansas economy was to eliminate the income tax, 9 of the 10 states that fared best in the recent recession have created the most jobs and have the strongest economies, don't have an income tax. If that was his policy, it should have been done completely. I'm in favor of a fair tax proposal. It should not be surprising that income tax revenues are down because we cut income taxes. What has been disappointing and what we have to find answers to are our reductions in sales tax receipts. Why are they down? And I will mention one other thing. It's a smaller part of the budget, but nonetheless, Kansas also relies on severance taxes, and the recent crash in the oil patch has greatly reduced those taxes as well. Mm-hmm. And we got to address those problems.
One last question from the audience. Name and where you're from.
Kathy Cook. I'm from Shawnee, Kansas. So, Representative Rubin, you're my representative in the State House.
Well, thank you for the privilege.
Couple of things. First of all, thank you both very much for signing the Transparency Act. That's extremely important. But I do want to point out, Representative Rubin, there are no minutes posted for your committee for the entire session this year. So that might you might want to look into that because that
they
that,
just haven't come out yet. They're actually on my desk. No, I review them before they come out.
That's not very transparent after 3 weeks for no minutes to be posted.
Oh, it's completely transparent. It's completely transparent. We post all of our minutes online for my committee. It takes time to process them, though.
Well, and then I want to address, you talked about unencumbered balances in school districts. Right. The state is supposed to have a 7.5% ending balance, and I don't believe you all are there, and you're asking our school districts to be as irresponsible financially as the state is. So I would reconsider asking them to be as irresponsible as the state has been. Yeah, okay. But finally, my question goes to you.
That's not at all true, but go ahead.
Finally, my question goes to you. As a state representative, you introduced today to lower the age for conceal and carry to 18. As a parent of a student at a university, that scares the heck out of me. So you tell me how that benefits our children.
I'll be happy to respond to all the inaccuracies in that question. First of all, I have among the most transparent committee. I'd say the most transparent committee. I run the most transparent committee in the Kansas House of Representatives. I tried actually to require all committee members to record their votes in committee, but I had a revolt on my hands, and frankly, leadership wouldn't back me up on it. So I backed off of that, but I do encourage all committee members to record all votes in committee, and I have all my votes recorded. We post all minutes like every other committee does. They cannot, you cannot snap your fingers and have them done. My committee assistant, who has many other tasks, also drafts the minutes. I have to review them. They have to go out to the committee members for review. They have to be approved, and then they are posted. And all of our minutes always are and will be.
And I want to get to the gun question because it's clear.
I'm ready with an answer, John Wilson.
I want you. Does that seem reasonable to you as a committee? You know, the transparency issue that it takes 2 or 3 weeks to get minutes out there?
Yeah, I would say, let me say, I got to say, John's heart is in the right place. And there are almost all the committees I participate in, it is a process. You have to vote on committee minutes. You have to get it all up there. And then, to be totally candid, we have a legislative website system that is, I mean, it's
horrible.
Documented in the news.
It's terrible.
Horrible. It's
nice.
It in and of itself is horrible for transparency. So I would say it's not uncommon for there to be like a kind of a stack of minutes that we vote on approve multiple sets at once.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get the lay of the land here. All right. This was going to be a topic anyway. It's always a topic on the show when we talk about the Kansas legislature. What is the benefit to the state of Kansas to lower the conceal and carry age to 18?
It's very straightforward. It's a matter of fundamental rights, and it is a matter of being honest about where we are as a society. I would challenge anyone that asked that question to answer a question from me. The impetus for my bill, which was introduced yesterday, to reduce the minimum age to apply for a concealed carry license, not open carry, not constitutional carry, but a concealed carry license with training and so forth, to reduce that age from the current age of 21 to 18, is because we as a society have long since concluded, and I'm passionate on this point, have long since concluded that when our children, young adults, are 18 years of age, 19 or 20, they are old enough to enlist in the military, to go into the service, to get trained on the use of weapons, to be issued weapons, and to take those weapons overseas and risk their lives to defend your freedom with that gun in their hand. And I don't hear any of you objecting to that. But yet when they come back home, they are not allowed to even apply for a concealed carry license, even though they've been carrying a weapon overseas to defend you. That is the reasoning behind the bill. That is the reasoning behind the bill. I also, as a matter of fact, object to the fact that our military service members under the age of 21 but over the age of 18 can't have a beer in Kansas and yet can risk their lives and give up their lives to defend our freedoms as well. Now, the fact is there's nothing we can do about that because we will lose all of our federal highway money if we try to lower the drinking age in Kansas to 18. But I think it is unconscionable that we ask young men and women to go over and put their lives on the line to defend us, and they come back home and we tell them they cannot have the rights of other citizens to carry the same weapon or a lesser weapon than what they had overseas. They can't buy a cigarette and they can't have a beer. I think there's something unconscionable about that, and that's what's behind that legislation.
Steve, I want to bring you in on this. We've also talked about guns a lot. You've done a lot of shows up to date about this. What is it that you want to know from Representative Rubin? What's the follow-up here?
Well, you know, on guns, I don't know, Sam. I think we've covered it pretty well here. I think we're hearing the yin and yang and pro and con here pretty quickly. We did a show just the other day about did a news item about the concealed carry on the KU campus and professors and administrators there up in arms about this. But there's the other side of the coin, too. We've had any number of mass shootings on college campuses in this country, and there's the pull of that argument. I think Missouri is beginning to take a look at this issue as well. So here we go. The debate continues.
John Wilson, your reaction to this? Are you for lowering the age for applying for a conceal and carry permit?
I have to say, I hadn't even heard you introduce that bill. So like anything, I need to read that bill. But I think here's the challenge I have without having looked at it. When we're talking about guns on college campuses, I don't think there's a place for guns on college campuses. With the current law as it is, though, in order to conceal, to constitutional carry, meaning carry without any extra background check or training, you have to be 21. Most students that live on a college campus are going to be 18 to 20. So by lowering the age to 18, you are more likely to have more students who have the ability to have a gun on campus. The difference between the constitutional carry and a concealed carry permit, at least, is that this 18-year-old would have training and a background check, which I'm going to do all I can, actually, to incentivize people to get a concealed carry permit. I think if we need to make them cheaper, whatever we need to do. I tried to do it last year. I tried to incentivize buying gun safety devices, but nobody would have that. But the thing that makes this such a thorny issue is there's the constitutional right that's built into this, which makes it more complex than a lot of the other things we discuss. And so I don't know where we're going to go with the gun conversation in the Capitol, but my focus, honestly, is reducing gun violence. And I think the way you do that is making sure people know how to use guns safely, and you make sure the people who have guns are the right people to have guns, and making sure the law enforcement have the tools that they need, and ultimately that guns are kept out of the places where bad people are likely to get them.
We're going to go to another question from the audience here, but just one quick follow-up. John Rubin, you would be in favor of increasing the amount of training or any training that you need before you can get a conceal and carry permit?
Yes.
You would be in favor of that training?
That's one of the requirements to get a concealed carry permit is you have to go through the training, and that's why I want to make it very clear. I did not propose constitutional carry without training for 18, 19, or 20-year-olds. That's not my proposal. It's the concealed carry licensing program that requires the background check and the training that Representative Wilson talked about. That's what my bill is. And I will say one other thing. There's another bill in the legislature. These things work in tandem. There's another bill introduced in the legislature that I wholeheartedly support to, in response to concerns, particularly by the regents, to allow the regents to designate the parts of their campuses that will be open to concealed carry and those parts that they will block from concealed carry by and comply with the statute by having metal detectors and wands and security equipment. And the advantage of that is that'll save the regents' universities a lot of money, courthouses and other places as well, because then they can provide the security measures in a limited area. One of the objections was the way the bill was originally written, and the big problem with the original bill on concealed carry was it required security measures throughout the entire university campus, and that was impracticable and too costly.
One last question, and you've got the last question here. Your name and where you're from.
My name is Chris Sendrick. I'm from Overland Park, and I also am on the board for Kansas Families for Education. I'm a retired school psychologist where I can tell you I never worked less than 10, 12-hour days working for children with huge needs. I am now a targeted case manager trying to squeeze services from CanCare, which is trying to get blood from a turnip. There are no services. What's unconscionable is the lack of Medicaid expansion, and I want to know, where are all these inefficiencies?
Medicaid expansion. We're hitting all the greatest hits
here tonight.
So where are you? Where are both of you on Medicaid expansion? We'll start with you, John Wilson.
Yeah. So just because I don't want to assume everybody knows what we're talking about, under the Affordable Care Act, states were given the opportunity to expand their Medicaid program. In Kansas, we call it CanCare. It's managed by three private for-profit companies. That's the background. I'm absolutely for expanding CanCare to cover more Kansans who need health insurance unequivocally. And I think there's a way, using a plan developed by the Kansas Hospital Association, to pay for it and not have to necessarily take away from any other state services. So I'm all for that. The challenge is the governor, or by way of his spokesperson, said that expansion of Medicaid is morally reprehensible. A challenge with a statement like that doesn't give you a lot of wiggle room for negotiation. But a bill has been introduced. Here's the challenge right now. I think it's being held up. We don't have a bill number, and we don't know what committee it's going to be referred to. I hope it comes to my Health and Human Services Committee. We had a discussion last year. I mean, literally 125 proponents in a 2-inch thick binder and maybe four opponents to Medicaid expansion, and yet it didn't go anywhere. It's a critical issue, not just for the health of people who don't have health insurance, but for the economy we're seeing now.
John Rubin, where are you on Medicaid expansion?
I really want to see the current bill being proposed that Representative Wilson talked about. It is modeled, I understand, on the so-called Indiana plan. It sounds interesting to me. It's been explained to me in broad outlines. I want to see the details. But what I understand it does is it saves the government of the state of Kansas from the exorbitant cost of the original Medicaid expansion proposal. Our legislative research department, which is a nonpartisan organization, scores bills similar to what the Congressional Budget Office does, and their estimate was over 10 years, Medicaid expansion, unfettered Medicaid expansion as proposed in Obamacare, would cost the state $2 billion more than we are already spending, and that is assuming, and I have no comfort that this will actually wind up being the case, that's assuming the federal government maintains its promise to continue to fund 90% of the Medicaid expansion, which I think is questionable. That's why I opposed the original Medicaid expansion. It would absolutely bust the Kansas budget. However, this proposal has, I think, very good possibilities, but I do want to, I haven't had a chance to study yet, and I do want to look at it.
Before we wrap it up, I want to go around one more time and get a final thought or a final question from you, Steve Krasner.
Yeah, I just want to wrap up the conversation on Medicaid expansion. I mean, to be honest and blunt here, expansion's not going to happen this year with the movement we've seen on committees, with the governor's statements here. To leave this conversation, if anyone had any hope that this was a possibility, I think would be a mistake. Am I right about that, John Wilson?
You know, I'm an eternal optimist. I've worked on a medical marijuana bill that nobody ever thought would get anywhere, but here it sits alive in the Senate after having passed the House. I would say this, there are some issues that are not going to happen until we change the makeup of the legislature. And that doesn't necessarily mean more Democrats or more Republicans. It means more free-thinking, reasonable people that are here to get the job done for the average working person.
John Rubin, the final word is yours.
The medical marijuana bill that Representative Wilson referred to was my original bill. It reduces the penalties for first and second time marijuana possession. We haven't gotten at all into... Thank you. We haven't... thank you very much. We haven't gotten at all into my...
You're bringing him around late in the game.
to my particular area of expertise as chair of the Corrections and Juvenile Justice Committee. That's a subject for an entirely different show. What I was saying at the beginning of with regard to public safety and the tightened budgets and the understaffing and ways that we can deal with it and reduce, we are over criminalizing in this state and in this nation, as I think I mentioned at the outset, and there are things that we can do about it. But this was one attempt to do something about it. We reduced the penalty in this bill for first time marijuana possession to a Class B misdemeanor. Second time to a Class A misdemeanor, and only third and subsequent time does it remain a felony. And Representative Wilson's amendment about medicinal hemp oil was added to that bill and it passed by a substantial margin out of the Kansas House, and it has been languishing in the Kansas Senate since last spring. It was just split apart and voted out in the Senate, and we're waiting for it to come back to the House where I'll get a chance to negotiate on it.
I know that look, Steve Krasky. You're demanding a follow-up, and so here it is.
Well, it's not really a follow-up. I just want to publicly thank Representative Rubin for coming here today and facing, you know, a challenging audience. And
thank you. Thank you.
John Rubin, I really appreciate you taking the time to
Thanks,
come here.
Thanks, Steve.
It was great of you to do it.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I appreciate
great.
That. Thanks.
Appreciate your responses.
Well, yeah, because Donald Trump called me and said he couldn't make it. So.
Funny, he never calls me. I don't know what it is. So we're going to leave it there. My colleague, Steve Krasky from Up to Date, thank you for being here.
Thank you, everybody.
John Wilson from Lawrence. John Rubin from Shawnee. Now, to get to know you guys a little bit better, as you know, we end the program with your favorite songs. John Wilson, last time you were here, well, you weren't really here. You were in the basement of the State House. And you went with End of the Line by the Traveling Wilburys.
Tonight?
Wilburys, I'm sorry.
Tonight, because some days are diamonds and some days are rocks, I went with Tom Petty's Walls.
John Rubin, when you were here on State House Glen, you went with Rhapsody in Blue, a fine choice, I thought. Tonight? Do you stand pat, or do you go with something else?
I stand pat on Rhapsody in Blue, but I added one, too. I asked Matt, your producer, if I could select two, and he said yes. So in addition to Rhapsody in Blue, by
You only get to pick one.
Okay. Well, since we did Rhapsody in Blue last time, the Beatles, and listen to the words of the song, are so vitally important. The Beatles in my life.
Wow. All right, now, usually I would pick the walkout music, but since all you guys are here, I'm going to leave it up to you. I don't want any partisan stuff, all right? I want you to pick the song that you like the best. So let's go with the Beatles. Beatles? This is going to be tough. Tom Petty? Man, you guys are tough. All right.
Which one's the American?
I'm going to have to break the tie and show my age a little bit, and we're going to go with the Beatles. There it is right there. State House Blend is produced by Matt Hodep. Hey, we had a lot of help tonight. Kyle Smith, Brianna O'Higgins, Chris Pruitt, Kyle Smith all helped us today. Now you can subscribe to State House Blend on iTunes. You can find us on kcur.org/statehouseblend. Steve Prasky makes a little room for us Tuesdays at 11 on Up to Date. We still got that deal?
Absolutely.
If you want to join us, if you want on a future State House Blend, go ahead and email me. I'm Sam at kcur.org. We also have some forums back here if you want to be a future guest on State House Blend. Are you guys a fan of the Twitter?
Yeah.
I thought I'd get a little bit more reaction to that. You can follow my co-host, Brian Ellison. He takes care of the Missouri part of State House Blend. He's at PTS Brian. You can follow me. I'm at Sam Zeff. Thanks ever so much for everybody being here, everybody being out there, and I'll see you guys around the radio.
About them in my life, I love you.